We present For One Horrible Moment by Peter Bradshaw. Episode 2. Sacrilege.
Previously on For One Horrible Moment. As a young boy, I have been rescued from playground bullies by an older girl called Susan. Someone to whom I am strangely drawn and who seems to bear a striking resemblance to me. While out bathing, I am surprised by a surreptitious note from her requesting a secret rendezvous. The Sabbath morn dawned rich and golden on the hard, unyielding fen, and Father had allowed my brother Edward and me a lie-in until 7. The day before, Ed had cut his forehead and sustained some bruising playing buckaroo, and so, thankfully, he did not care to join me on my morning walk. What a pleasure it was to be striding through the level fen that fine summer morning towards the 8th-century church of St. Job, patron saint of pox sufferers. Instinctively, I seek a stick with which to thrash boyishly at the hedgerows and fling for my faithful terrier, Jif Moose. I call out, "Jif! Jif Moose! Jif! Jiffer! Jif Moose!" But turning round, I see that the old dog is cringing and shivering and hanging back, apparently terrified of some malign spirit in the air. I had seen him like that only once before, when the entire family were in Clacton-upon-Sea and were about to have a ride on Steel Stella, the funfair roller coaster. Jif Moose whined and fretted so much we had to leave the funfair, and just as we did so, Steel Stella collapsed, killing 38 people, starting a fire which burned a further 74 people alive, and causing a rupture in the sewage pipes which triggered off one of the biggest cholera epidemics in Northern Europe. So when the prescient Jif Moose whined, we listened. You'd better believe it. But this time I ignored Jif Moose's warning, and went onwards to the church without him, impelled to obey Susan's strange command. She had told me to meet her there, and that is what I had to do. St. Job's itself was a rather high Anglo-Catholic establishment, hated by my sternly Presbyterian father, who had strictly low church principles. He was a keen member of the Cambridgeshire branch of Jews for Jesus, and once described the Pope as worse than Billy Bremner. It was another reason to keep this visit a secret. The church's great oak door opens unwillingly, and I see that the congregation itself is soberly and discreetly dressed, except for Susan, whom I can just make out in the church's obscure gloom. She is dressed in calf-length suede boots with fat zipper and the briefest possible corduroy mini-dress, which accentuates her pale thighs and full womanly breasts. She appears to be paying no attention to the service itself and is listening to her squat, pink transistor radio through an earpiece, swaying rhythmically in her seat and occasionally saying, "Ooh, baby." Catching sight of me, she gives a faint and enigmatic smile. Observing her there in the sepulchral half-light, I am again struck by her beauty. My heart leaps at the snub nose, the hazel eyes, the tight brown pirate curls. How similar to me, and yet how different from the rest of her family, her parents and 3 brothers, whose faces are gaunt and framed with lank blonde hair, frowning identically over their prayer books. Soon the time comes for us to go up and take communion. Susan and I are the last 2, and we kneel together at the communion table, or altar, as they sacrilegiously call it here at St. Job's. The priest is a man of some bearing, with a fierce face, hypnotic eyes, and a strange resemblance to Roger Delgado, the actor who plays the Master in the television series Doctor Who. He places a communion wafer on each of our outstretched tongues. Just at that moment, there is the loud ringing of a telephone. "I'd better go and answer that," he says. He departs, leaving Susan and me kneeling alone at the front, the wafers on our tongues. I am about to swallow the dry, tasteless wafer when I am aware of Susan's arms around my neck. Her face is very close as it had been that fateful morning in the playground. Only now her chest and thighs are touching mine. Her tongue, on which the wafer still reposes, finds its way inside my mouth. Under a particularly dense cloud of incense, she leads me away suddenly through a side door into the sacristy. Its spectral calm is disturbed only by chirpy, chirpy, cheep, cheep. Susan turns the radio off and places the pink box on a low teak shelf, and all I can hear through the closed door is the dull murmur of the congregation at prayer. From a darkened alcove, Susan produces a large silver goblet encrusted with jewels and Masonic emblems, brimming with fortified communion wine. She drinks, long and deep, and then beckons me to do the same. I soon feel hot and dizzy. "Oh, I feel unwell," I murmur. "Oh, sweet, are you all right?" she whispers, coming very close, her hot tribormint breath on my neck. How sweet her tender solicitude. "I don't know. I think I'm going to faint," I stammer, staggering a little. She puts out her arms to me, and I am delighted to say that, unwell as I am, I have the presence of mind to cop a pretty good feel before going down. When I came to myself, I was back in my bedroom. Standing by the bed was my mother, tense and unhappy as ever, my brother Ed, carrying a whimpering Jif Moose in his arms, and my father, grimly weighing Mr. Swishy, the corrector, in his left fist, his mood clearly more in anger than in sorrow, much more. With him was Mrs. Hennessy, the treasurer and sole other member of the Cambridgeshire Jews for Jesus branch. "Son," says Father at last, "we received a telephone call from the Vicar of St. Job's in Haslingfield. He found you this morning stark naked in a grotesque posture in the churchyard, in some sort of catatonic trance. Your clothes were in a bundle nearby. Fortunately, your library ticket and I Spy Cambridgeshire books were among them, which enabled him to identify you. We managed to get you home in the car by pushing you quite roughly into the boot of my Hillman imp. What on earth were you doing there? What possessed you to desert our church like this for St. Job's? I really do intend to beat you very savagely indeed." My mother gives a great cry of fear and grief. Father turns to her impatiently and says, "Not you, him." He turns back to me. "I have already beaten Jif Moose, who was clearly failing in his duty to warn you of these snares of delusion." I would like to be able to report that I was outraged by my father's treatment of a defenceless dog, but instead I offered to beat him again myself, if that would lessen my punishment. But Papa was unmoved. "I will first leave you with Mrs. Hennessy, who will attempt to talk some theological sense into you," says Father. Solemnly, my family file out of the room, leaving me alone with Mrs. Hennessy. She smiles. "Your dad asked me to have a little chat," she says softly, "because I know what you're going through. Adolescence is so difficult. Lad," she says, laying a kindly hand on my shoulder, smiling sadly, "do you think I don't know what it's like to want to get naked in a churchyard and lose consciousness in a grotesque posture?" "It wasn't like that," I whimper. Could I confide in Mrs. Hennessy? This was a woman who spent every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon walking around with my father, attempting to convert Cambridge's sparse Jewish community to Christianity. For this she had been twice beaten up, and the magistrate had actually commended the attacker on the grounds that Mrs. Hennessy was, in his official words, a pain in the arse. But I had to trust someone. Falteringly, I recounted to her my strange meeting at St. Job's, and this mysterious older girl with whom I felt a strange affinity. Mrs. Hennessy is silent for a moment, and then asks, "Is her name Susan?" Before I can express my astonishment, Father bursts in with Mr. Swishy, which glistens somewhat, as he has obviously been improving its wind resistance with Johnson's baby oil.
"That's it. You've had long enough," he barks.
Mrs. Hennessy leaves, her brow deeply furrowed. Father begins by thrashing my stuffed nylon penguin so that it erupts in a shower of kapok. Then he orders me to put out my right palm. He steadies it with the hand that is not holding Mr. Swishy, then leaves the room and walks to the end of the landing and down to the bottom of the stairs, in order, as he puts it, to get a good run up. Sometimes, During his punishment run-ups, he would get confused, lose his way, run out into the street and hit Mrs. Flange, a woman with a surgical boot on her left foot with a heel measuring 16 inches. It isn't long before I hear a terrifying Zulu cry and a thundering as Father runs up the stairs, along the landing and into my room. Just as Mr. Swishy is poised above his head, I ask, "Who is Susan, Papa?" Mr. Swishy's downward sweep goes wildly awry as Papa gasps and goes pale with shock. He breathes heavily for some moments, but does not answer my question. Finally, he says, "Let this be a lesson to you," and leaves with a curt nod. After my punishment, I ran through the house, gulping and wincing with suppressed tears. Instinctively, I sought out the comfort of Mama's room, where I was often wont to find solace in embracing her, or in her absence, the perfumed cushions and valances of her daybed. I knocked and entered. Mama was not there, and her embroidered Terry Jack sampler lay unfinished on the dresser. I roamed about, sniffling and pouting, fingering the many photographs of the Duke of Kent, dominated by a giant heart-shaped portrait. I picked this up and weighed it experimentally in both hands. As I did so, a strange thing happened. Out from between the gilt backing of the frame and the portrait beneath the glass, an old photograph slides onto the floor. Picking it up, I can see it is a creased black-and-white snap of our family on holiday years before in Hunstanton. There is my mother, there is my brother Ed, then 10, there I am, at 6, and there, unmistakably, is Susan, though not apparently much younger than now, and in a sleek one-piece. How can this be? I remember the holiday well, though I can't remember Susan being there. How can she have been? Father had insisted we visit Hunstanton for a summer holiday. Just before the photograph was taken, Papa had made Ed drink a pint of seawater for smoking a Henry Winterman cigar while he was having a donkey ride. That explained Ed's rather unhappy expression in the photograph. It was a rather strained familial setting. Mama was just going through the menopause, and Father thought it would be psychotherapeutic if the whole family periodically went through what he called empathetic hot flushes. At a given signal, we would all have to stagger round the beach with our ice creams and shrimping nets, claiming that we all felt hot and weepy. Father even once forced the deck chair attendant to join in. When this didn't work, he told me to give Mama the painting I had done in art class, to cheer her up. It was a rough crayon representation of a desert, with cacti and green darting lizards. I had called it Mum's Womb. She burst into tears of emotion and said she wanted to go back to the B&B. Before Papa would agree to any such thing, he insisted on a photograph. I remember lining up with Ed and my mother, but Susan, how could Susan have been there? If I think hard and picture myself facing Papa and the camera, I can just sense someone else out of the corner of my eye. When I look back to the days of my childhood, a rich, warm feeling of contentment suffuses me. I sometimes think that the past is not another country, but a house left deserted for years, with yellowing post and free newspapers and mini-cab cards all mounded on the doormat, and dust everywhere, and a fridge full of rotting food, and a funny smell coming from one of the rooms. The sort of house that I think I could really be at home in.
For One Horrible Moment was written and narrated by Peter Bradshaw. The producer was John Naismith.